You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas.
And this is the start of the sprint to Election Day, a little less than 3 months hence. And I think it's important to think about this election as doing two things. One is it's going to determine whether or not the House of Representatives and the Senate are going to be in the control of a party that is adversarial to the president. But the other is that there is a lot of tea leaf reading happening within both parties, but especially the Democratic Party, about what election results say about the direction the parties should take. And we've seen a lot of this playing out in Democratic primaries across the country. The most notable example was the victory of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in unseating the fourth highest ranked Democrat in the House in her primary in a district of New York. And in California, a similar battle is going to be playing out on the state level, on the general election, because of our top two primary system. We're joined now by Kevin De Leon. Until this spring, he was state Senate president pro tem here in California, which is one of the most powerful policymaking positions in the country. He has trained his sights for his next job on the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Dianne Feinstein. She is running to remain in that seat, but he has secured the endorsement of the state Democratic Party. Kevin De Leon, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for having me. It's a real honor.
And I should mention, for the sake of our audience, that we have reached out to Senator Feinstein to offer her equal time covering this race, and they have not responded to our requests. Why don't you start with the elevator pitch? Why are you putting your time and energy into unseating a fellow Democrat?
Well, I think it's time for a change. I think it's time to give a voice to those who have no voice or little voice in California. We're the fifth largest economy in the world, yet this economy clearly is not working for everybody. We have left millions behind, and there's panic, there's anxiety, there's a sense of angst among many Californians, among many Americans who simply are not able to make ends meet. And the reality is this, with a Trump administration who has California in its crosshairs, we need leadership in Washington that's not on the sidelines, but actually on the front lines, not someone who preaches for passivity or patience with this president, with the hope that perhaps in the future he could become a good president. That's not what working families in California want. That's not what they need. And I think that having a choice for voters in California on the November 6th election ballot is a good thing.
Why don't you get specific? The pitch Dianne Feinstein can make to her constituents is the pitch every incumbent can make. She has a ton of seniority. That means she's able to slip a lot of goodies into appropriations for the state of California. You come in, you're going to be lowest ranked on all the committees you go into. So what are you going to do substantively differently? What votes are you going to cast differently if you go to the Senate?
That's a very good question. And I would say that seniority means absolutely nothing if you don't use that seniority for policies, for measures that improve the human condition for everyday families. For example, I would never vote for two wars, both Iraq and Afghanistan, that to date have cost American taxpayers $6 trillion, $6 trillion that we should have used to invest in Medicare for all, for clean energy policies, for debt-free college education. To date, we have over 7,000 Americans who have lost their lives in these two senseless wars that to date have not made the Middle East or the other parts of the world safer, but in fact, less stable. I would never have voted for a wall 10 years before Donald Trump ever started talking about a wall with our friends, with our neighbors to the south of us, with Mexico. I would never have voted for a huge GOP tax plan, the largest of its kind until just recently, December's tax plan by Donald Trump, that just gave the wealthy more tax breaks and more money, leaving programs that are so critical for everyday families throughout the country with less money. And so there's a huge contrast between our core values, our beliefs, and the votes and how they're manifested every day.
And then thank you for those specifics on the votes you would not have taken. What are policy proposals that you would put forward upon taking office that you have not seen Senator Feinstein take action on?
Well, the issue of Medicare for All, I think it's Medicare for All. It's not Medicare for some. The majority, well, I shouldn't say the majority, but we have a lot of Californians whose HMO, whose PPO is not Blue Cross or Blue Shield or Kaiser. It's the ER room of their general public hospital within their specific counties throughout California. We still have many Californians who have no access to quality health care. We need health care for all, not health care for some. And I think that taking a public stance on the issue of Medicare for All and pledging to work with fellow U.S. senators and members of the House to move this issue forward is really critical. Elevating the minimum wage to $15 an hour, was successful in doing so here in California. It's not a living wage, but we should increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour because nobody who works full-time, I'm talking about full-time, should have to be forced to live in poverty in the wealthiest state in the nation. The issue of climate change, there are no better leaders or policies in the nation than here in California when it comes to climate change and therefore economic growth and creating jobs, high wage paying jobs for everyday Californians. In California, we have been very successful. We have created 500,000 jobs in the clean energy space in California alone. That's 10 times more jobs in the clean energy space in California than there are coal mining jobs in all of America. So this has a positive impact, whether you voted for Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, or Donald Trump, or any other Republican presidential candidate. This lifts the human condition for all Californians and for all Americans. It's about leadership and taking a proactive stance, not just being present and just voting for measures in a static manner. It's about actually taking the baton and moving the force of your values, the courage of your convictions, and moving these policies. And I get it and I understand it. Some folks have said, well, you know, you're in the minority. Obviously, that's going to be very, very difficult, given the Republican leadership in Washington today, too. You still elevate these policies to a national level. You have the debates. You have the policy arguments that you can capture the imagination of everyday Americans on what is possible. And I think that's the type of leadership that Californians want today.
Let me walk you through some of the issues that seem to be most sharply dividing the Democratic Party right now. First of all, free public higher education. Where do you stand on the bill that Senator Kamala Harris is presenting on that front?
Well, I support it 100%. Listen, we have invested a record amount of dollars in California for the University of California, as well as the CSU system, but it's still not enough. And I think it's about our values and our priorities as a nation. We spend little over half of our federal discretionary dollars on the U.S. military. I think there's no better investment than investing in our human capital. That's why America is the greatest country on planet Earth, because we invest on our young men and women and those who return back to school to acquire a new skill set, a different type of degree, depending on their career choice. But we have young men and women today who graduate, and they're not graduating in 4 years. They're graduating in 5, 6, 7 years, because we don't factor in the total cost of education. It's not just tuition and books, but it's something called life, which is you got to pay your rent, you got to pay for food, you got to pay for your gas or your bus pass, you got to pay for transportation. And oftentimes, for middle-class kids, lower middle-class kids, working-class kids, kids who have never gone to college before, it's taken them 5, 6, 7 years to graduate from a four-year university. And when they do graduate, they're carrying the debt, the principal and interest with them well into their 30s, well into the 40s. And if we have created a higher education federal loan program industrial complex, I just made that up right now, where we have for-profit, you know, entities that are reaping a tremendous amount of profit, you know, on students in not just in California, but throughout the country. So I support it 100%. It's about our values and priorities.
Abolition of ICE.
I do. Now, I will tell you this. I've had a lot of folks talk to me about it for quite some time. I did have some reservations. I asked my staff to do a deep dig on the research on ICE, and I looked at the research, and I came to the conclusion Yes, and this is the reason why. When it was created, ICE was created with the help of the senior senator, Dianne Feinstein, with her vote with the Homeland Security Act. We were in the wake of 9/11, a national tragedy that impacted us all greatly. But ICE's focus was supposed to be on terrorists, on drug and human and gun traffickers, on cyber sex pedophiles, not focusing their time, energy, and resources on mothers and fathers, on mothers who are selling paletas or tamales on a street corner, whether it's in front of Lake Merritt or in the Mission District or in East San Jose. But we have a White House that has weaponized this police agency, and they have politicized ICE to carry out their political agenda. And that's why today we have a rogue police agency that has focused its energy, its time, and its resources unnecessarily, the American taxpayer dollars, on picking up folks who have been here 10, 15, 20, 25 years. And through no fault of their own, they have not been able to normalize their legal status because we have a Congress. And there's plenty of fault across the political spectrum in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think you've made a good case against ICE. But let's get down to brass tacks. What does abolition of ICE mean to you? You dismantle a large, sprawling law enforcement agency. What next? Do you get rid of its responsibilities? Do you transfer them?
I think it means different things to different people. For some folks,
so what does it mean to you?
Reforming the agency altogether. From other folks, it means to, give me a quick second, it means to defund them altogether. I think we need to defund ICE. And then I think we need to, in a very careful, thoughtful manner, figure out what the objectives of this agency should be. And then we move forward.
So there still would be an Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency left under your version of abolition?
Well, you know, I can't answer that question quite yet, because that's why we haven't gotten to that point where we actually would tackle what happens after the dust settles down specifically, because obviously we've been campaigning up and down the state of California. But I will say this, is that in my district, which has the largest number of immigrants in the state of California, ICE has had a disproportionate impact on my constituency. And again, the focus has not been on criminal violent felons, but rather on everyday mothers and fathers taking their children to school or going to a community health clinic. So I do believe that we have to dismantle ICE today. What we do specifically afterwards will yet to be seen.
What about the question of impeaching President Trump?
Well, I support it, and I always have supported it since day one. I think that this president makes Richard Nixon look like a choir boy. And I believe that we have plenty of evidence to move forward with impeachment. Now, whether that happens because of political dynamic in Washington with both chambers being controlled by the Republicans is another thing altogether. But this is something that I've always supported from day one. I made the decision when Trump was elected through the Electoral College system on November 9th, the day after the election in 2016, that at least my role and responsibility as leader of the California State Senate would be to resist and resist with results. Because when folks talk about dog whistles are what Republicans have been doing for the past 10, 20, 30 years. Trump has been using a bullhorn, and Trump has signaled very clearly what he would do if given the opportunity to occupy the most powerful position in the world, the presidency of the United States. And sadly and tragically, to many Californians and to many Americans, he has not disappointed his base. He's come after hardworking immigrants. He has tried to upend our clean energy laws, clean air, safe drinking water acts, Endangered Species Act. Just recently, as we know, that he's trying to dismantle the California fuel efficiency standards that has a huge impact throughout the country, less smog, more money in your pockets because you're not spending as much money at the gas pump. He is not disappointed. So on the issues with regards to his own personal businesses, dealings with the Saudis, dealings with the Russians, I think there's plenty of evidence to impeach his president.
We're speaking to Kevin De Leon. He is a state senator representing California's 24th district, that's East LA and downtown Los Angeles. Until this spring, state Senate President pro tem, and now the man who would be senator. He has the state Democratic Party's endorsement in that race, but he is running against another longtime incumbent Democrat, Senator Dianne Feinstein. Her office, by the way, has not yet responded to our requests for an interview. We're going to be taking your calls in just a moment. 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your questions to Kevin De Leon.
Senator De Leon, first, another question for you from us. You have spoken about green energy jobs, and that's looking at further very needed attention to the demand side of the fossil fuel climate change equation. What about the supply side? There are calls for increased policies that focus on keeping fossil fuels in the ground, starting here in California, but also looking nationally. What is your position on keeping fossil fuels in the ground?
Well, I've always been a strong supporter of clean energy, and obviously the issue of fracking. I've always been a strong opponent against fracking. I think it's imperative, especially what's happened with the wildfires, or what's happened with drought, what's happened with our summer temperatures. It's always been hot during the summer. It's hellaciously hotter during the summer months now. And my concern that this may be the new for California, for the rest of the country and other parts of the world. So we have to accelerate and do everything within our power to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. And therefore that means keeping it in the ground as opposed to extracting it. And we have to move to renewable sources by decarbonizing our grid and going beyond that and dealing with tailpipe emissions and trying to electrify our transportation system in California, throughout the world. I have a measure, which is Senate Bill 100, which would take California to 100% clean energy, decarbonizing our grid by the year 2045. So let's keep it in the ground and let's move forward with a new technologies and innovation that will catalyze our economy and put everyday Californians and Americans to work.
All right, we're going to bring some of our callers into the conversation right now. First on the line, we have Antonio in San Leandro. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, Mr. De Leon, the Democratic Party had control in Sacramento for at least the last decade, and you were one of the leaders. And still the housing situation in this state is one of the worst. And it has to do precisely because of your policy for encouraging the flooding the state with illegal scabs and the sanctuary policies for criminals. What can you say to that?
Senator, well, I obviously, you know, I would say with much respect to you, Antonio, I stand strong on my values on the issue of sanctuary states, given this administration's objective and goal for mass deportations, and therefore wanting to commandeer local police departments to be an extension of the Trump deportation machine, I made a decision to move forward Senate Bill 54, which would prohibit our local police departments throughout California, our sheriffs, from collaborating and cooperating with ICE agents to pick up ordinary immigrants who've been here for years, if not decades, and again, have yet to be able to normalize their legal status because a Congress has been asleep at the wheel in Washington. So I don't believe there's a correlation with the issue of either crime or housing or the environment or traffic or congestion or anything else when it comes to the issue of immigrants. And I think that plays into the arguments of the Trump administration. So I stand proud.
Well, let's set aside Antonio's diagnosis of the causes. There's indisputably a housing crisis and a housing affordability crisis in California. What would you do from a perch in the U.S. Senate to try to address it?
That's a very good question, because we do have a crisis. We've always had a housing problem in California, but now it's metastasized to a crisis. And state government now has gotten involved. We have a general obligation bond that will be before the voters that I helped negotiate from Senator Jim Bell. That's $3 billion that we hope to leverage with private sector money for about maybe $10 billion in total, a one-time dollars to build affordable housing. But at the federal level, I think that the federal government has to play a larger role. It's not just about Section 8 vouchers and federal housing that was established back in the 60s and 70s. I think the federal government has to play a much larger role in terms of capital that's available at a very low interest rates for working families, for middle-class families, to be able to purchase a house. We have an issue with regards to the number of housing units that are available. We have limited stock. We need to start building more, but we need to start building more in a very intelligent manner that doesn't harm our environment. So I think we can do both.
Sorry, to clarify, it's when you say building more, do you mean building more market rate housing or building more public and subsidized housing?
I would say all of the above, not just market housing, because market housing is not going to help those who don't have access to the capital or the credit rating to access the loans necessary to get into those available units. So it's all of the above.
I mean, we're in a policy regime where for more than three decades, the federal government has slowly been retreating from funding affordable housing. Appropriations for HUD have been on a steady decline. The money it is spending is increasingly going towards privatized policy frameworks, vouchers like Section 8 that are effectively subsidies for landlords, low-income housing tax credits that are subsidies for developers that only keep the housing they build affordable for 30 years from the date of construction. What would you be pressing for in terms of federal policy that would change that?
Well, that's a very good question. And the issue of Section 8 housing and the more privatized movement of the retreat from federal government because of the past Republican administrations, I would move, like I said earlier, I would move policies that would provide more access to capital, especially for those who have very low FICO scores. I think it's absolutely critical because folks who have from low-income families, from low-income neighborhoods, whose credit rating is they're not able to access that type of capital. We have to work on programs that liberalize and relax, if you will, the standards to receive a loan that's affordable. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we can do at the federal level.
So your solution is more home ownership, laxer credit. Isn't that what got us into the 2008 financial crisis?
No, not necessarily, because I think we went overboard on that right there. When the market overheated and we went to derivatives and hedge funds, and they started slicing and dicing these credit default swaps and selling it on the worldwide market and taking pension plans, that's what got us into the mess. And I think what happened was is when anybody could secure a loan, I'm not saying that anybody should be able to secure a loan. You have to have the ability to pay it back. But I think we have to be smart in our approach. You don't go from one extreme to another extreme where unless you have a perfect FICO score, you can't access a loan. Where it was on the other extreme where the big banks made out like bandits, wrecked the economy, and working class Americans have been paying for it ever since.
Yeah, I guess my question, and I asked that badly, and I'll stop monopolizing your time and let our callers back in a second. But
no, that's okay.
The government spends over $70 billion subsidizing home ownership through tax breaks on mortgage interest. That's more than twice what it spends subsidizing renters through housing and urban development programs. I guess my question is, what about all the people for whom home ownership doesn't make sense? They're not in a point in their career where they're going to stay in the same place for 5 years. They're not ever going to be able to put together a down payment for a home, whether or not they can get credit. What about that vast swath of the American public that's not in a home ownership track?
And moreover, to address climate change, the necessity of people moving into buildings where they are more likely to be renters and not building home after home after home is a critical policy change as well.
Well, I think part of the policy changes is when you build, whether it's for subsidized rental units or whether it is for home ownership, you have to build in a way that is not going to harm the environment and it's not going to create a large commute to and from your residence, whether it's a rental unit or whether it's home ownership to your job. So we have to do this in a very intelligent manner. I agree with you. It's not just about having access to capital and low interest points to purchase a home, but it's also to the issue of individuals who are not going to be able to put together the down payment and are going to rent, and they're not ready to rent and may not want to rent for their reasons too. So I think that we have to deal with subsidies with that population too. And that's why when I said earlier and I made the correlation with regards to how much money we spend, federal discretion dollars on U.S. military, and what our priorities should be. We should have a national debate on the issue of housing. We don't, because this is primarily, historically, this has been a local issue for local city councils, local governments, and local county board of supervisors. And we have retreated at the federal level greatly, where they've been privatized and manifested, as you stated, through vouchers. It's hard for folks to use those vouchers when there's no stock that's available. But that's just, you know, scratching the surface. So I would agree that we have to focus also too on the issue of those who are not going to access capital to purchase a home.
All right, let's bring some more of our callers into the conversation. We've got Andy on the line from Redwood City. Morning, Andy.
Good morning, Mr. Tinker, Ms. Rojas, and Mr. Nunez. Mr. Nunez, round this out, I will vote for you. I mean, no question, and I do hope you win. But man, you got a tough case to make, because Ms. Feinstein is just so attractive to the Republican voters. And the other caller, Antonio, called up SB 54. That's kind of the way I position you as well. That is not a bill that helps working class people. Just my general comment. And that's going to be tough to overcome. I know you put up a good argument for it, but it's going to be tough. HAVA, 2002, Help America Vote Act. Ms. Feinstein was one of the big promoters of that. It really put a lot of money into giving us electronic voting machines across this nation, which have been horrible as far as being able to get accountability in our whole electoral process. I'd of course, like to see us go back to paper ballots. And I know Rob Wyden, I believe, has got a bill out there to bring paper ballots back so we get more accountability in the whole process. What do you think about that as far as getting rid of the HAVA stuff? Let's go back to paper.
Senator Nunez. Well, I know this. I'm really concerned right now with the potential hacking of our systems, not the potential hacking, but the real hacking of our systems by foreign governments, in this case, the Russians and the Chinese as well, and upending the electoral results for their own political economic interests. So going old school, if you will, as you say, going to paper ballots, I'm totally open to it. I've had conversations with our own Secretary of State, Alex Padilla, here in California, and I'm not quite convinced that our electoral system here, with regards to the way the system is run, is as smooth or as protected as it should be. I think that there was the right intentions were there with HAVA, but I don't think that they have really panned out today.
We're speaking to Kevin De Leon. He is a state senator right now, until recently state senate president pro tem. Now he's running to be California's junior senator. If he did that, he would unseat fellow Democrat Dianne Feinstein. Next on the line, we have Harry in San Francisco. Morning, Harry. Harry, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Sure. What's your question?
Yes, I wanted to know what Kevin De Leon's positions are with regard to the military, exactly with regard to Israel, Saudi Arabia, and so forth. How does he differ from Dianne Feinstein, and what would he have done differently had he been able to vote on things such as authorizing the invasion of Afghanistan?
Well, earlier in the interview, he already said he would have voted against Iraq and Afghanistan, so we'll clear that out of the way. The question was on Saudi Arabia and Israel. How would you be different?
Well, I've always had deep concerns about the Saudis, their relationships with our U.S. government, the exploitation of resources from the kingdom of Saud to create and fund Wahhabism schools throughout the Middle East. I don't think they have been our friends, and I don't think they've been our allies. But I think they have their own political interests that have not been our interests. And I think that we have used American personnel, men and women, to go and defend the Saudis as well as other satellite countries that protect, obviously, their oil interests. With regard to Israel, I've always been a strong believer in a two-state solution. I have deep concerns of what is happening, no doubt, in the Gaza Strip. I have deep concerns what's happening with expansion of the settlements, which I think undermine any potential peace process. Ultimately, this is not a military solution. This is a political solution, and difficult decisions need to be made. I've never been a fan of the current leader of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu. I think that it requires real leadership, and I think there's no one more pleased that Donald Trump is president of the United States right now than Netanyahu, because I think he's been playing him like a violin. Obviously, when you continue to expand the settlements, that helps. That does undermine any real potential peace process for peace. There needs to be peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. We need a president and we need a Congress that will provide that leadership, that strong leadership, and sometimes very hard leadership to bring them to the table and to leverage our power to keep them at the table in an honest manner to find a political solution, which is not which is very difficult, but it should be done, because if not, instability will continue in the Middle East.
Senator De Leon, two key elements of our of the U.S. government's support for Saudi Arabia right now are playing out in billions of dollars of weapons sales to the Saudis, which are being used in horrific and likely illegal means in Yemen, put on display just this past weekend with a horrific bombing affecting many children. And so the first question is, what would you do in regard to those weapons sales? And then the second question is, the other primary way that we're supporting the Saudis right now is in significantly increased tension and policies implementing extreme sanctions with the threat of even more sanctions on Iran, with the likely goal of regime change in Iran. So let's start with weapons sales to Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and then turn to Iran.
Well, specifically with regards to the weapon sales
Saudis.
The Saudis, I would never have voted for weapon sales. We have been doing this historically with the Saudis. I know the Saudis view the Iranians as their arch enemies and vice versa, but we have witnessed what is happening with the atrocities in Yemen. And we have witnessed a much more outwardly hawkish military position that the Saudis have taken, especially with their new leader in Saudi Arabia. And this is something that we should never approve. And this goes back to the very cozy relationship that the Saudis have had, you know, the current king and past kings with almost every president that occupies the White House in the United States. We have been historically dependent on the Saudis and the manipulation of the price of oil and OPEC and the extraction of fossil fuels in the Middle East. And it has cost Americans lives. It has continued to pollute our Earth, and it has destabilized that region.
What about military aid to Israel? You condemned settlement expansion. It's an unambiguous violation of international law. We give that country more military aid than any other country in the world, more than $3 billion a year. Would you vote to cut it off?
I wouldn't vote to cut it off. I would have to review it and see. And you just gave a price tag of $3 billion. One thing I am cognizant of is Israel is surrounded by many folks who would seek to do away with the state of Israel, who don't believe in the establishment of the state of Israel. I did have an opportunity to visit Israel, and I went to various areas, and I do believe in the state of Israel. I do believe that there's some very severe political problems in Israel, first and foremost the issue of the Palestinians. But I think they would take a review of the budget, specifically what it's being utilized for, specifically because we have to be cognizant that Israel is surrounded by many folks who would wish to eliminate them altogether from the map.
But you talked about using leverage, your word, to get Israel into political talks for a peace deal with Palestinians. If you are not going to put their direct funding from the U.S. government on the line, then what leverage are you going to apply?
I didn't say we would eliminate, but I'd say, if it was a reduction in terms of the funding from the U.S. government to Israel, I will just say this, is that, and you may have answered my question, I'm open to all types of leveraging points that would keep Israel safe, but also force them to the table to find a peace deal with the Palestinians. First and foremost, we must have peace in the Middle East, and we, as the biggest superpower in the world, have to use our political and economic leverage to bring all sides to the table to find a lasting peace that's sustainable.
All right, let's try to bring in one more caller. Ellen is on the line right here in Berkeley. Good morning, Ellen.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Thank you so much for having this. Two questions. One is the $15 an hour minimum wage is, I think everybody agrees that that is not enough, but at least it's a start. But the issue that underlies construction workers, hotel workers, in-home health care workers, and so forth, is the fact that African-American workers are not getting jobs as readily as Latinos because they're being paid by the owners of these construction companies, many of whom have government contracts, under the table. And I wanted to know what you would do to help make sure that everybody gets a fair shot at the jobs, whether they are U.S. citizens or not. And this also affects New England, the New England shot of people who come in from Montreal, the Francophone-speaking workers who are not documented, the Italian and as well as the Middle Eastern workers who are not documented, and the Eastern Europeans who are not documented in the East Coast as well. So your Senate position would also affect that because there is a lot of non-documentation among those groups of folks who are also displacing African-American workers. That's the first question. Second question.
Ellen, we're short on time, so we're going to have to cap it at one question. Senator De Leon, we've got about a minute.
This is a huge question. I'm going to try my very best. I thank you for the question. I helped negotiate the minimum wage, the highest in the nation, which is $15 an hour. You are correct that a minimum wage is not a living wage. A living wage is much more than a minimum wage, but it is a start and it's a baseline to hopefully build up. If I'm given the opportunity to be your voice in the U.S. Senate, I want to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour for the entire nation. African-Americans and African-American males specifically have been disproportionately impacted by an unjust criminal system, high unemployment, underemployment. We do have a black market of folks, obviously, who have been paid either in cash or below the legal minimum wage in the state of California. That we have to crack down on, regardless of who the individual is, whether you're from China, whether you're from Mexico, whether you're from Nigeria, whether you're from Quebec or from Ireland or whatever. It doesn't make a difference to me. Because that has an impact on all Californians, on all Americans. But I want to say this, as we move forward with lifting the minimum wage, hopefully to a living wage, that has a positive impact on all workers, regardless of the hue of your skin, we also at the same time have to move forward immigration reform at the federal level that brings people out of the shadows and into the fabric of our society so we don't have the depressed wages that currently exist today. Again, it's not an either or. It is both. They're complementary and inclusive of each other, not exclusive of each other. And I think that will have positive impact on wages and benefits for African Americans. As we know, regardless of the hue of your skin, wages and benefits have been assaulted in America. No more pension plans, defined benefit programs have been moved towards defined contribution. If you're lucky enough to have a defined contribution at your place of employment. I have always supported defined benefit programs and will continue to do so. But these are policies that we can move forward that will have a huge impact on all individuals, regardless of the hue of your skin.
But Senator De Leon, you're going to have to finish the conversation on the campaign trail because we are done with time for the hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Kevin De Leon is a state senator representing downtown and East L.A. Until this spring, he was Senate President pro tem, and now he is running for federal Senate. To win that seat, he would have to unseat the incumbent, Dianne Feinstein. It is a Democrat-on-Democrat battle in November. And that does it for today's show.
Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect to us on social media.
If you want to sound off about something you heard or suggest something for us to cover or someone for us to interview, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org.
Big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Producer Corinne Smith, engineer Rod Akil, hosts myself, Antonia Yuhas.
And me, Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
Also Gina Madrid and Janine Etter. Our interns are Justin Gould and Clara Sophia Daly. Also Mitch Deserick and Eileen Alfandari.
We almost got them
almost.
All right. If you want to send us a letter and are not in a position to do it via email, you can write to Upfront, KPFA, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California, 94704. Stay up and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way in 20 seconds at 9 o'clock.
You are listening to, KPFA 94.1, KPFB 89.3, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, and K248BR 97.5 in Santa